Warning, the podcast you're about to listen to may contain graphic descriptions of violent assaults, murder, and adult language. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to the Murder Police Podcast, the murder of Megan Liebengood, part 4 of 4. So he starts talking because you're all patient with him. And does he tell the whole story of how it started, or does he not completely tell it? Where do we go from here to learn how the story unfolded?
Rob, I'll let you tell them what he said. And I think his is probably the most accurate. I'm sure he left out a little bit of what he probably did, but I'll let you go ahead and give the scenario how they came upon Megan from what this juvenile says.
Sure. The three individuals had gotten together early in the evening, and one of them had mentioned hitting a lick, which in street terminology is committing a robbery. So he knew that the one individual had a gun. They kept walking through the neighborhood. It was getting dark, looking for easy prey, basically. And, you know, come 10 o'clock, and sure enough, here comes an 18-year-old girl barely weighing 100 pounds. It's not going to get much easier than that. So this individual didn't think anybody was going to get shot. So they approached the female, demand money and cash or whatever she had on her. She didn't have anything. They get upset. The one individual with the gun says, get in the trunk. Obviously, she's terrified and refuses. And at that point, the one individual with the handgun looks at the other two and says, should I shoot the bitch? And to our disgust and frustration that we've talked about for years, that murder may not have happened if one of those two said, no, dude, let's just get out of here.
Yeah, she doesn't even have money.
But they didn't care enough about a human life to just say the word no. And that was an odd moment in the interview where I was just kind of forgot about the case and was just so angry at the senselessness of it. And just all you had to say was no, don't, let's get out of here. But neither of them cared. And with the silence, the individual simply shot Miss Liebengood in the head.
Do you think he wanted her in the trunk so they could maybe pilfer through her stuff, or so she wouldn't see them? Or were they going to drive off with the car with her in the trunk? Or did they even tell why they wanted her in the trunk?
I think they weren't thinking that far in advance. To them, putting her in the trunk, that gave them options, all the options that you're talking about. One, could we drive her somewhere, take advantage of her, sexually assault her? Since she doesn't have anything, we're going to get something. Two, that gives them time to pilfer through. She's so scared, she won't make any noise. No one's going to hear her in the trunk. We'll just leave her there, grab her stuff, and leave her there. I mean, they had all those options, but she wasn't going to go in that trunk. So he
shoots her.
Which explains why the evidence was thrown about and the trunk was completely empty, which is what Rob and I thought, but you shouldn't make that assumption at the scene.
No, but that's great to have it. Such a great corroboration of the scene evidence. Again, that's priceless. That small thing is priceless.
So does this second person lead you to the third person?
Well, we know who the third person was, right? Because we got the arrest warrants. But he does give us information of who else, a girlfriend was involved, helping them get rid of evidence and helping them hide out. Well, because they saw all the police arriving at the scene and they had to run. So they go to the girlfriend's house and hide out there and change clothes.
Oh, wow.
So he does give us that information.
And she was the girlfriend to him or to one of the other two people?
To the third suspect.
So now you know your third suspect, and this is the one that you go to the girlfriend's house to get.
Yes, this is the individual where he marked me as far as what a human can do and to care nothing of human life. So, Rob, yeah, Rob took over through part of that interview because I just, there's a certain point in a, I would think in a detective's career that, you know when you had enough is enough and you don't want to lose your job. So you need to kind of separate from that. And that's what happened in this interview.
Yeah, we were both really frustrated, especially dealing with the first two and then dealing with the third one. And he was by far the worst as far as attitude and arrogance. And there was a point in the interview, again, it was the same as the other two. They didn't admit right away. It took quite a while to get to the truth and get this individual to admit he was there. And again, Chris had the great idea with the maps, and suspect number two and number three, their maps lined up identical, where the first one was he'd already lied about naming another individual. His was just completely off. And the other two's, you know, matched up with evidence at the scene, but he kept referring to her when he finally admitted to being there. Yeah, the bitch went to her car. Yeah, then that bitch came out and the bitch wouldn't. And we said, so it's like, this individual has a name. Her name is Megan. Do not refer to her as a bitch again. And again, his attitude really didn't change. But we got what we needed out of the interview and charged him with the murder. And Chris, we eventually charged his girlfriend. Correct.
Yes, we did. Yeah. And again, we had to play the recording because he said, I don't believe you. I don't believe they would ever give me up, which again, you're so give you up for what? I mean, thanks for saying that.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah. So, yeah, we play the recording for him. And that's when he started drawing the map. He knew it was over at that point. But yeah, his girlfriend, she was quite a delight as well. And
I was going to ask, how was the interview with her?
She was the toughest one to break of all of them. And she wasn't even at the scene. It took forever. I mean, a couple of hour interview to get her to admit to her part about getting rid of some evidence and stuff for the boyfriend.
What do you think finally got her to click?
We charged her. Remember, she was not going to say anything, and we had enough without her telling us anything. And I think that was what we said. This is your choice. We're going to charge you. So it's what role you really played in this is what you need to tell us. Because you're going to get charged, whether it's murder or whether it's tampering with physical evidence. So she had such an attitude and wouldn't come off of, I didn't know about it. So I didn't know whose the purse was. So I suggested they throw it into the dumpster. Yeah. Like she didn't do it, right?
So she really, at that point, if she's not cooperating, she's more of a facilitator to the murder.
Absolutely.
So she was charged as such. And I think Chris was right. She wasn't going to give it up. I think she thought we were bluffing. Until Chris put the cuffs on her and told her she was being charged with the murder and tampering with physical evidence.
She was a juvenile as well?
Yes, yes.
But, you know, going back to the number three and what you heard with the way he talked about Megan and whatever, that points to another thing that lay people don't understand. And a lot of times lately in the past several years, especially with a juvenile, they'll get in a jam, the police will charge them with murder or a prosecutor will charge them with murder. And there's this immediate rush to mitigate, no matter what the hell it is, to mitigate what that is. Oh, they need treatment. Oh, that, you know, here, what are the mitigating factors? And I've always said that unless you've sat in a room like you two did, knee to knee, before attorneys, before therapists, before psychologists, before psychotherapists, before counseling and all that, you don't know. And you're sitting in a room with the devil. I mean, and that's the way I finally, after years, it's narcissism. They are the center of the world and nothing does matter. And it's sad because people will sterilize that and start to make arguments as to, well, they probably shouldn't be in prison that long, you know, and it's like, no, you haven't seen this demon and you haven't heard this demon talk. And I'm just a big believer in the balance of good and evil, and that's evil.
And they don't really, as far as dealing with juveniles in the system, there's a big difference from 13 to 17. But the court sees them all as just a juvenile. An individual is 17 and a half years old and commits a heinous crime. Their sentence is going to be much, much lighter than if they were 18 in a day. And I think it really does a disservice to juveniles. We've had a case where I think Dave, you were involved, and Paul Williams is a cashier over on Old Mount Tabor was shot.
Exactly.
And this juvenile, he committed a couple of robberies and some assaults, some fairly serious stuff, and just gotten a slap on the wrist in juvenile court. Well, he had just turned 18 and was charged as an adult, and was honestly believed he was going to boot camp for 2 years. And when former Sergeant Williams informed him, like, no, you're an adult now, and he got 25, 30 years, he almost felt sorry for him because he had been trained by the court system that nothing bad is really going to happen to me. I can do all these things. I can steal money or whatever. I'll spend a couple of weeks at juvenile detention, going to school there, and then you're released. So when that happened and he had crossed over into the 18-year range, it was a rude awakening for him. And he was honestly confused as to why this mattered so much.
It's a huge issue. I remember that, I'll just say it candidly, I hated going to juvenile court the amount of time because it was ridiculous most of the time. The only time I liked going is a youthful offender hearing, which is what these cats ended up getting. And for the listener, what that is that you've done the right amount of crime or the severity of the crime at your age, that there will be a hearing to determine if you're going to be tried as an adult. I thoroughly enjoyed that because I saw that more than once. We would look across that set of tables and we would watch that awareness, and they were packed up. And the way it always worked, they'd go to the juvenile facility because we don't put juveniles in adult jail. But I remember asking one of the people, he was a guard over at the juvenile facility. I said, what do you do when they turn 18? He goes, at midnight, we come in and wake them up. I give them a Snickers and tell them good luck. And they go off and they go to look through liquor or rotor. And it happens at midnight. And there's the real world all of a sudden. But getting back to your point, and again, I don't want to rabbit hole too much, but it's important, is not only do we put the community at risk, but what you just said too, Rob, is that we're leaving them out against themselves. And they're either going to get killed or they're out and they're such a danger to themselves that they're going to get tried as an adult and they're going to do decades in a facility. And I don't think there's a win in any of that. No. And again, we probably really need to get the better bourbon out one night and have a big discussion on how we can fix the system. But, and I'll say this for the listeners, we haven't named them. However, if I'm understanding correctly, every one of them went to a youthful offender hearing, right?
That's correct.
Tried as an adult in circuit court as an adult, correct?
That is correct.
Do you remember that? And to get people to understand this is that even if you're 17, you're now in big boy and big girl court, and you're in a whole different environment than back in the trailer over at
that's right. Your mother still has to sit in the back of the courtroom. She doesn't get to sit at real close to the defense attorneys.
Exactly. Do you remember, if you can't, just what they were sentenced when this happened?
Yeah. So the actual shooter was suspect A, based on the maps and the testimony by everyone. He was the actual shooter, and he got 40 years for murder. So he will be released in 2044. The one that cooperated was suspect B, the one that gave us the larger statement, the larger admission, and drew the probably what we would call the safest map. He got 10 years in understanding that he would have to testify against the other two. So he pled guilty knowing that he had to testify against the other two. And then the last one, the one that I disliked a little bit, got the same sentence, 40 years, and will be released in 2044. Unless, again, they've been in trouble in the penal system and they'll get charged with something else and add it on to their sentence.
We can only hope.
Exactly.
Why did he get the same sentence as the shooter? How does that work?
Well, really, they were all charged with murder. The suspect B made a plea in agreement to testify against the other two. And really, it was just the jury. They heard all the evidence, all the facts, and they're the ones that came up with the sentence. So I think they could tell. They listened to the interviews that Chris and I had. We played those in court, and they could tell what kind of person he was. You know, they could tell our anger at him calling her a bitch. You know, so they got an unfiltered look into, I think, his character.
Sure.
And I think that's why they dropped the hammer on him, even though he wasn't the one that pulled the trigger.
But he was just as unremorseful as the trigger puller. Right.
And when you plan to do this, it's just like the best analogy, and we even use this in court. The best analogy is if you're even a lookout at a bank robbery and the people that went inside that bank shoot an innocent person, everybody's getting charged with murder,
right?
Because you're facilitating. You're a part of the plan. You're a part of the action. The first step that you take to intend to rob that bank and a death happens, you're just as guilty.
Now, the girlfriend, her charges?
She was charged with, just like we suspected, with tampering physical evidence. She received 5 years.
So both she and the person that testified, they're out now. I feel confident because this was in 2004.
Yes.
Any more hearings of them, dealings with them?
No. From time to time, I'll check in to see if you know they've been involved with anything, and nothing of any significance.
Gotcha. Well, God bless that jury. You know, on another episode that people will listen to is we talked to Jane Ford, who had been on a capital murder jury trial before. And specifically, she spoke to how that attitude of the defendant, well, she spoke to prosecutors and defense attorneys too, but talked about how that attitude of a defendant actually weighs so much back in that room on top of the evidence. So that's a pretty stiff sentence. And Lord knows, without being there at trial, they probably had a lot of guilt thrown at them. You know, it's what defense attorneys do, and we love them. It's their job. But they probably had a hefty bunch of stuff thrown at them, especially during closing, to try to sway them away from 40 years.
And what's great is one of the better defense attorneys who make a detective better was the defense attorney for one of the defendants, and her name was Kate Dunn.
Oh, yeah. I love Kate.
And it was a battle going and testifying in front of her. And it was, she's one that would ask the same question 8 different ways, just hoping you'll trip up and agree with her. So you had to really be on your toes with her.
Kate probably might be, for new police, might be the biggest fear in their career to go to court. But the reality of it was she trained more police than she ever knew.
Absolutely.
And did it great. She would kill you on cross and drill you. But I always, to this day, I have an immense amount of respect for Kate Dunn. And not just because she helped me get better at what I'm doing, but you know, we've said it before, when you hire an attorney, I want a fighter. And geez, oh, Pete.
And it was vice versa, though. She respected you at the end of the trial.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Fantastic woman. Yeah. And but boy, if you weren't used to that and weren't ready for it, I've seen people, woof.
Yeah, but you only don't prepare for one hearing with Kate Dunn.
Exactly.
Once. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, they say that thoroughbreds can smell sneakers. She could smell you new on that stand, and it was kind of entertaining to watch.
Yeah.
Now, did we have our beloved Ray on this as well? Was he here hearing this?
He was not. It was Cindy Reeker. Actually, and she did a tremendous job.
Oh,
she's
yes.
a good attorney.
Yes.
Yeah. I'd like to back up a little bit. We blew over the evidence kind of. And one thing, so that was the 17th we made all those arrests, right? So that was 2 days after the homicide. So some of the listeners don't realize, but that's just the beginning of our work. So Rob and I were thinking, they were monsters, right? At least 2 out of the 3. And I don't know whose idea it was, but we went and got their school records to show that either they were attending the day of the murder or the day after. If they were bothered by the murder, it would show something, right? Well, it showed suspect A, the actual shooter, went to school the next day and took tests, and he got 100% on all his tests.
Yeah.
I don't think he studied that night.
Yeah, let's not.
I don't think
he's just naturally smart.
Yeah, this isn't academic advice. Let's not confuse people.
Wow.
Just stick to the books.
He murdered a sweet little girl at 10:30 and was up the next day at 8 a.m. going to a class. And
business as usual.
Absolutely.
They have no conscience with this. And again, that's something people, let them sit behind bars and think about the mistake they made. Well, no, that's not true. They fantasize. A lot of them masturbate when they think about it. Let's be candid. It's a sick group of people. Unfortunately, it's a small group of people so far. But, there you go. No, they don't. It's not there. If the capacity was there, they would have said no. That's the whole – you hit that perfectly, Rob. They would have said no.
Right. And some of the listeners don't know this. We sent the grocery bags off, right? What a great piece of evidence for prints or DNA. Mm-hmm. Well, believe it or not, KSP Lab got partial palm prints and fingerprints. Well, here's the problem with the juveniles. If they've never been in trouble or even if they're juvenile, they're not in what we call the APHIS system. Their prints are, you can't compare their prints to anything. So before our arrest, there was nothing we couldn't have that leverage of, your prints are everywhere. We couldn't do it.
There's another community alert. We all know that the violent crime is moving down every year in age and keeps going down to this. Now we have this group that's untraceable. I'm telling you, hang on tight. We're in a bad spot. We can't recover that like we can an adult. Anything else you want to add?
Yeah, it was Chris, again, was a primary, and he took the huge burden on his shoulders. And in 2004, I was still relatively young. I think I'd only been in the unit 2 years.
No, not young.
Yeah.
Well, so I really did just – it was a great opportunity for me to learn how to do an investigation right by the book and be tenacious about it.
Especially given how angry it could make you. Jeez, oh,
yeah.
I mean,
well, I do want to ask, did either of you go and speak with the husband after to tell him that you had found the suspects? And do either of you have contact with him still today?
We always try to contact the family after an arrest. It's the worst thing for the family to find out through the media. So we, prior to the press release is what they call it at the police department. Prior to that, we do contact the family members, whether in person or over the phone, depending on their location. I don't keep in contact with him.
Well, we stayed in contact with him for a couple of years because of the trial was ongoing. So we do stay in contact with the family. And a lot of time, it's up to them if they want to continue a relationship with us. We're certainly happy to talk to them anytime they want. But a lot of times I found that family, once the trial is over, it really is they close the door and just move on. So continuing talking to us is only going to stir up memory. So, yeah, after the trial, I don't believe we've spoken to the family.
And that makes sense. They're trying to, as Greg Davis said, metabolize this. It doesn't close, you know, you don't have closure. He was really big on that. But
yeah, I hate that term, that cliche.
Yeah, he was big on that.
It's a chapter.
Yeah, he said it becomes who you are. It's a part of right. who you are. And then it's after that, it's just how you deal with it.
Well, gentlemen, thank you all so much. The case, what a sad case. Not that any of them aren't sad for the victims who suffered this, but just to imagine the sheer fear that this girl had, probably knowing that she was going to get shot. And when the guy asked the other guys, should he do it, and they validated yes or didn't say no, I can't imagine what the poor girl went through. So, you know, I guess what a great job you all did. Tireless efforts, digging through trash and just nonstop. So thank you all for your dedication to that. And thank you for sharing the story about Megan and her brutal murder. And thank you for coming to do a podcast with us again.
Thanks for having me again and again and again and again.
And there'll be another again.
Yeah, happy to be here anytime.
Yeah, and for me too, and on behalf of the listeners, thanks for taking everybody inside the room. That's a big part of what we try to do here is to let people, anybody can tell the story. They can get the details and put it out, but you actually took the time to make this very personal and talk about the why and the how, and especially the emotional impact and how hard that is to work. So thanks for doing that. And it's another great way to honor a victim of a violent crime. So thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Murder Police Podcast is hosted by Wendy and David Lyons and was created to honor the lives of crime victims so their names are never forgotten. It is produced, recorded, and edited by David Lyons. The Murder Police Podcast can be found on your favorite Apple or Android podcast platform, as well as at murderpolicepodcast.com, which is our website and has show notes for imagery and audio and video files related to the cases you're going to hear. We are also on Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, LinkedIn, and YouTube, which has closed caption available for those that are hearing impaired. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe for more and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcast from. Subscribe to the Murder Police Podcast and set your player to automatically download new episodes so you get the new ones as soon as they drop. And please, tell your friends.
Lock it down, Judy.